To continue our discussion of the objectivist ethics, quoting from Galt's speech, "To live, says Galt, man must hold three things as the supreme and ruling values of his life: reason, purpose, self-esteem. Reason as his only tool of knowledge, purpose as his choice of the happiness which that tool must proceed to achieve, self-esteem as his inviolate certainty that his mind is competent to think and his person is worthy of happiness, which means is worthy of living." Close quote. It's worth pausing a moment to contrast the three ruling values of the objectivist ethics, reason, purpose, and self-esteem, with the three corresponding alleged virtues of traditional morality, which would be faith, renunciation or self-sacrifice, and humility. Mystical ethics would teach that not the exercise of his reason, but the abandonment of his reason in faith is one of the cardinal requirements of virtue. That virtue requires and consists not of purpose, not of productiveness, not of gaining values, but of sacrificing them, of relinquishing them, of renouncing them, of surrendering them, of giving them up. And that virtue consists not of valuing oneself, not of valuing one's life and one's mind, but rather of disvaluing them, that is, of exhibiting the virtue of humility. Ask yourself which is the root that leads to man's life and which to his self-defeat. Does his life depend upon reason or upon that state of unconsciousness called faith? Does his life depend upon producing values or upon sacrificing them? Does his life require that he consider himself competent to live and worthy of living, or that he consider himself unfit to live and unworthy of living? Then, in answering this question, you will know why we call the morality of mysticism a morality of death, because its cardinal values are precisely those which are inimical, actively inimical, to the requirements of man's life, survival, and well-being. The process of living is a process of self-generated and self-sustaining action. Life is a process of self-sustaining and self-generated action. And that means that the process of living is a constant process of working for the achievement of values. This is a process inherent in life itself. Life is action. Life is purposeful motion toward a goal. That is the meaning of life. The emotional concomitant of successful action is that psychological state which we call happiness. The alternative of happiness and suffering is the internal psychological form in which man experiences the alternative, which in existential terms we recognize as that of life and death. Happiness is the state of consciousness which results from the fulfillment of one's values. Happiness in life is made possible in principle by two means, by two related means. It's a concomitant of action, of the process of acting to achieve values, and it's also a concomitant of the process of enjoying or consuming values already achieved, either by oneself or by someone else. Happiness is, in a word, the successful state of living. Happiness is the successful state of living. Just as life cannot be achieved by any random means a man may imagine, So happiness cannot be achieved by any random means a man can imagine. Just as man can drag himself through his life as a cripple, so that his existence is really a process of progressive suicide, so the psychological corollary or concomitant of that same anti-life mode of existence is an internal state of psychological torture, a frustration, of misery. The purpose, says Galt, of morality is to teach you not to suffer and die, but to enjoy yourself and live. But how to enjoy yourself is precisely what has to be learned. That's precisely what is not self-evident. One of the most absurd, almost farcical mistakes which many people believe is that morality is not necessary for happiness or for the enjoyment of life. That any idiot, any moron, any unprincipled whim worshiper acting in any way he blooming well pleases preserves intact his capacity to enjoy life. Well, any psychotherapist should laugh at that particular piece of nonsense, because psychotherapist offices are filled with the human wreckage of people who believe that happiness does not require any particular conditions, that it can be reached by any route they happen to feel like. If it could, one wouldn't need such a profession as psychotherapy. Perhaps psychological illness, neurosis, misery, neurotic anxiety, neurotic depression is one of the most simple, eloquent, and dramatic means by which nature dramatizes to us the fact that happiness requires the fulfillment of specific conditions set by man's nature. Consider the following to begin with. One of the differences between a rational pleasure and an irrational one, or a rational value and an irrational one, is in terms of its consequences for one's happiness. A rational pleasure doesn't carry a hangover or a kickback with it, meaning because it is pro-life, it doesn't carry a penalty. It's in the nature of any irrational pleasure, of which drunken unconsciousness is perhaps the best example, that it always carries a hangover, a kickback of a negative kind, as an integral part of it. And there is a reason for this, which we can appreciate very simply. The only way to hold a consistent code of values is to hold a consistently rational code of values, because if your values were consistently irrational, you'd be dead. If none of your values were right, you couldn't exist at all. Therefore, among the living, there are only the people whose values are inconsistent and those whose values are consistently right. But nobody's values could be consistently wrong. Such a man would perish if some of the things he wanted weren't right. Now, consider this then. If you hold contradictory values, inconsistent values, this means that the satisfaction of one value will entail the frustration or negation of another. If, for example, among your values are the desire to enjoy life and to have security and a stable, predictable existence, but you also decide that you want a nice little shortcut via being the profession of bank robber, why then, the price which is paid, even if one is not caught immediately, is in terms of the frustration of other values. And there isn't any possible escape from this principle, and that is why any irrational pursuit at one point or another always acts destructively for the life, the well-being, the happiness of the organism, the human organism. I want to quote a very important passage from the speech which Ayn Rand gave in 1961 at the Wisconsin Symposium on Ethics, which NBI subsequently published. I refer to the speech entitled The Objectivist Ethics, in which Ms. Rand states, and I quote, "The maintenance of life and the pursuit of happiness are not two separate issues. To hold one's own life as one's ultimate value and one's own happiness as one's highest purpose are two aspects of the same achievement. Existentially, the activity of pursuing rational goals is the activity of maintaining one's life. Psychologically, its result, reward, and concomitant is an emotional state of happiness. It is by experiencing happiness that one lives one's life in any hour, year, or the whole of it. And when one experiences the kind of pure happiness that is an end in itself, the kind that makes one think, this is worth living for. What one is greeting and affirming in emotional terms is the metaphysical fact that life is an end in itself. But the relationship of cause and effect cannot be reversed. It is only by accepting man's life as one's primary and by pursuing the rational values it requires that one can achieve happiness. Not by taking happiness as some undefined, irreducible primary and then attempting to live by its guidance. If you achieve that which is the good by a rational standard of value, it will necessarily make you happy. But that which makes you happy by some undefined emotional standard is not necessarily the good. To take whatever makes one happy as a guide to action means to be guided by nothing but one's emotional whims. Emotions are not tools of cognition. To be guided by whims, by desires whose source, nature, and meaning one does not know, is to turn oneself into a blind robot operated by unknowable demons, by one's stale evasions. A robot knocking its stagnant brains out against the walls of a reality which it refuses to see. This is the fallacy in hedonism, in any variant of ethical hedonism, personal or social, individual or collective. Happiness can properly be the purpose of ethics, but not the standard. The task of ethics is to define man's proper code of values and thus to give him the means of achieving happiness. To declare, as the ethical hedonists do, that the proper value is whatever gives you pleasure, is to declare that the proper value is whatever you happen to value, which is an act of intellectual and philosophical abdication, an act which merely proclaims the futility of ethics and invites all men to play it deuces wild. Close quote. If a man is caught up in some moral decision where he doesn't know what action is appropriate and he comes to you for guidance, you tell him nothing if you tell him, act on whatever will make you happy. Because the answer of a sane, intelligent, rational man will be, but how am I supposed to know what will make me happy ahead of knowing what makes sense? I don't begin with my emotions. I begin with wanting to know what course of action, in fact, is going to lead to my long-term self-interest and well-being. That's the whole problem. To say, do whatever makes you happy, that will give you the answer, implies that the answer is already there in my emotions. But if I already knew the answer, I wouldn't ask the question, what should I do? The question is, what will make me happy? That's precisely what I'm trying to decide. What will best serve my happiness? That's the question. The answer to it isn't, and can't be, follow your happiness, which means follow your feelings. That's just evading the very problem I'm trying to deal with. Since reason is man's basic tool of survival, since man lives and succeeds and achieves happiness only to the extent to which he recognizes the facts of reality and adjusts his actions accordingly, only to the extent to which he's able to act efficaciously and efficiently in reality, for these reasons, the foremost virtue of the objectivist ethics is rationality. What does rationality mean? It means, first of all, the acceptance of reason as one's only source of knowledge, one's only judge of values, one's only guide to action. It means constant commitment to a state of full intellectual focus, to functioning on the conceptual level of awareness. It means dedication to the principle of constantly seeking to expand the range of one's awareness, constant dedication to the principle of intellectual growth. It means a commitment to the fact that reality is real, which means to the principle that one's goals, one's values, one's actions take place in reality, and therefore, one does not sacrifice one's knowledge of reality, one's perception of reality, one's judgment of reality to any other consideration. Nothing can be higher than reality. No value can be sought at the expense of blinding oneself to reality. It means commitment to the principle that one's values, one's desires, one's decisions, one's conclusions must be validated by a rational process of thought, as honest, as conscientious, as scrupulous a process of thought as one is capable of performing. Of course, for a full presentation of what it means to function as a rational being, this you will find all through Atlas Shrugged. There you will see in scene after scene, in a great variety of the kinds of problems that human beings can come up against, what the principle of rationality means in practice. When Reardon is struggling to understand his family, and no matter how hurt or bewildered he is, he goes on thinking. He's trying to understand. That is the virtue of rationality. When he works, trying to discover or invent rather Reardon metal, abandoning one unsatisfactory solution after another until he gets what he wants, that is the virtue of rationality. When Galt refuses to try to let Dagny stay in Atlantis, to get her to stay there, knowing she's not yet sold on the rightness of his cause, when he knows that that would just be a fake which wouldn't give him what he wants, and when he isn't tempted by it, that is the virtue of rationality. The scenes, the issues in Atlas Shrugged in which you will see what that human quality means, that complete dedication to the fact that the fact is a fact, it's not to be evaded, it's not to be escaped, there are any number of examples. Witness, for example, Galt's policy towards Dagny in Atlantis. The attitude he takes toward what he has done relative to her at first condemnation of it, or hurt at it. Look at the various kinds of pressures under which the various good characters often have to function and how they preserve their cognitive clarity and keep their brain functioning no matter what. That is the virtue of rationality. That desire to know, to grow, to do better, to always stretch one's brain, to learn more, to do more. That is the virtue of rationality. First and foremost, reason as one's sole standard of truth. That means a complete repudiation of and rejection of any variety of mysticism. A refusal ever to place one's wishes or fears, meaning one's feelings, above one's rational judgment. A concern with the why of one's every conviction, not holding or maintaining convictions arbitrarily or capriciously. A profound respect for facts. A commitment to the principle that one's desires and goals have to be held in the full long-term context of one's life. That one has to function by means of long-term principles as a human being, not as an animal whose foresight can't extend beyond the next half hour. It means a concern to permit oneself no contradictions among one's ideas or one's desires. It means a respect for the law of causality, meaning never to permit oneself desires without concern for what it would take to achieve those desires, meaning no desire for effects without concern for the necessary causes. It also means no concern for actions, no pursuit of actions without a concern for their consequences, for the logical consequences to which they will lead. No acting on the premise of, it's my function to act, somebody else has to worry about the consequences. And here, a very important issue. Never to allow the range of one's action to exceed the range of one's thought. Never to allow the range of one's action to exceed the range of one's thought. Meaning, when one acts, one has to know what one is doing. One way of appreciating what the virtue of rationality means is by studying the archetype in Atlas Shrugged of the irrational man, Mr. James Taggart. In any issue, his primary concern is not what is true, but what would I like to be true? Not what exists, but what is it convenient for me to see? Not what is possible, but what do I want? Not how was it to be gotten, but only I want it. Let somebody provide it somehow. One of the magic words in the arsenal of the irrationalist is that word somehow, which always means somebody. Somehow always means somebody. When a person permits himself irrational desires with no concern for how they're to be gotten, and answers when queried, oh, somehow, he means somebody. Somebody will provide it. Now, some of you might wish to ask the following question. Granted that, as a general principle, man should always remain in full intellectual focus, granted that he should function long range, that he should be guided by principles, that he should be concerned to know the reason of his convictions, granted that he shouldn't hold values or desires or goals out of context, but he shouldn't permit himself contradictions, granted in all the fundamental, all the major issues of one's life, obviously it's to man's self-interest and well-being to function as a rational being. But aren't there surely certain absolutely marginal issues in life to which the concept of rationality surely doesn't and cannot apply one way or the other? Where reason is irrelevant in the choice of a movie, which movie will I see tonight? In the choice of a flavor of ice cream? How could one possibly be rational in such issues as these? What could the principle of rationality mean in such issues as these? Well, consider. Let's take, first of all, the case of a choice of going to a movie. Suppose, for example, that you're sitting home one evening and you're thinking, I'm going to go to the show tonight, and you know that you have the time to spare to go to the show and that you would like some form of entertainment pleasure. So you look at the newspaper, and there are two movies you'd like to see, both of which you have reason to think would be worth seeing. And you say, I don't know, I just feel like seeing movie A tonight rather than movie B. I don't know why, it's just the mood I'm in. And so you go to see movie A. Would you say that that's an example of acting non-rationally? If you would, check your premises. What's the principle that's applicable here? When you are confronted with two or more alternatives, and you know that in the nature of the case, no choice can be wrong, meaning that there's no objective reason why one should see one movie rather than the other, since you plan to see them both in this particular case, but I'll give you other examples later. In a word, when you are confronted with alternatives, choices, where you know in the nature of the case no choice can be wrong, why then it is quite rational to decide to go on the basis of whatever movie emotionally attracts you most. You may or may not be able to identify exactly why you're more in the mood for a movie A rather than B. If you're a good introspector, you'll probably be able to know. And you do know, as a general fact of human psychology, that sometimes, according to the events of our day or our context, we can be more in the mood to see one movie than another, and there's nothing per se wrong or strange about this. And what makes either choice honestly and legitimately optional is the fact that in the nature of the case, you can know in advance that no matter what you see, it cannot be a wrong choice. Under what circumstances might it be? Well, suppose you have to study for an exam tomorrow, and you know you're not prepared. And the choice now isn't between movie A or B, but between staying home and studying and going to any movie, even one you've seen six times, just to get out of the house, let us say. And you know that it's very much against your self-interest to go to a movie tonight because it's important to pass this exam and you know you're not prepared. Well, then the fact that you happen to feel in the mood to see movie A, B, C, D, or X becomes quite irrelevant. Because here you are dealing with alternatives where clearly the choices are not equal. One choice is objectively preferable to another. You have to, in effect, know under what circumstances it's appropriate to follow your feelings. For example, a very crude, simple example. You're out for a walk on a summer day in a field, let us say, and suddenly you take it into your head that you feel like running, and all you are aware of is that you're feeling very good, and this would give you an emotional experience of pleasure. Well, this is not irrational because rationality consists of taking cognizance of what is the context in which you are functioning. There couldn't be any possible argument against your running. And if there couldn't be any argument against it, And if you know it will give you an experience of pleasure, why then it becomes rational to do it. But you have to know that. So that if, for example, you're a severe cardiac case, the fact that you happen to be in the mood to run doesn't mean that you should do it. Rationality requires that you be cognizant of the context. I'll give you a rather facetious, humorous example of this. Some years ago, talking to a young man, he got hung up on the following problem. Namely, somebody had said to him, well, how can you be rational all the time? You're out on a date with a girl, let's say, and you park the car. What are you going to start discussing, astronomy or the celestial motions? How can you be rational all the time? Well, of course, the error here is in assuming that that would be rational. Being rational all the time doesn't mean being always engaged in the process of problem solving. Part of what being rational means, indeed a crucial part of what rational means, is knowing in any given context what sort of mental processes are appropriate to that context. And I don't mind telling you there's a whole lecture in that last sentence. I said to you several weeks ago that man's biological distinction, one of his biological distinctions, is that man is self-regulating with regard to the action of his consciousness. And this involves, among other things, the decision concerned with what type of mental processes are appropriate to different contexts. And obviously, it isn't the case that the same kind of concrete, literal mental processes are identically appropriate in all possible contexts, except the most fundamental one of being conscious, of course, and knowing what you're doing. But, for example, if this young man is studying for his exam or working on a mathematical problem, then it's appropriate to be engaged in a purposeful problem-solving activity. If he's out on a date with his sweetheart and he's parked the car, that is not the kind of activity that is normally appropriate. And one would question his rationality if he thought that it were. And therefore, a crucial part of rationality is taking cognizance of context and seeing that one's mental and physical actions are appropriate to a given context. Take still a simpler example, perhaps the silliest. How can one be rational in one's choice of ice cream flavors? Well, I've already given you the principle by which to answer that question. In one's tastes in food, two factors clearly are involved. One factor, of course, is association. We form certain associations with certain flavors. Secondly, there's considerable evidence to suggest that there are certain inherited physical factors which will be relevant to taste preferences in food or drink. Therefore, again, if you are weighing, shall I have a chocolate ice cream cone or a vanilla or a strawberry? You can know in the nature of the case that there is no such thing as a wrong choice, unless you happen to be allergic to one of these flavors or be dreadfully overweight, etc., 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 and there that you can fill in for yourself. But there are issues in life in which all of the options are equally valid. And maybe you could say, well, I don't know by what association I happen to like chocolate more than banana cream. What difference does it make if you never know how you happen to form that preference, or you never happen to know what particular physical inherited factors might be involved? What you are able to know is that it doesn't make any difference in this particular case. That's what you have to be responsible for knowing. Now then, in the course of the next lecture or two, I will be concerned to pursue further this whole issue of what are the principles, the values, the principles of action which man's life requires for its successful fulfillment. But before concluding this evening's discussion, there is one last issue relevant to the clarification of the concept of man's life as the standard that I want briefly to touch on. In principle, I have already covered this point, but experience has taught me that sometimes students are confused by it, and therefore I want to elaborate on it now. When we say that The objectivist ethics holds man's life with a life appropriate to a rational being as its standard of value. This means the objective requirements of man's life qua man in the full context. It does not mean that in any value choice, one's only or foremost consideration should be one's immediate physical self-preservation. Man's life as the standard of value does not mean that in any moral choice, the primary consideration is only, or first of all, your physical self-preservation through the span of the next moment of your existence. Indeed, such a policy not only is not entailed by the principle of man's life as the standard, more than that, it's actively incompatible with the standard of man's life. Why? Well, remember, life, as I have said, is a process of self-sustaining and self-generated action. The life proper to man, as we have seen, is a process of pursuing, achieving, and enjoying values. The values which his life as a rational being requires. But in the nature of reality, in the nature of life, the pursuit of values entails a struggle. And struggle entails risk. The pursuit of values necessarily involves the possibility of failure and defeat. A rational man does not rebel against this fact as he does not rebel against any metaphysical fact of reality. Therefore, to choose to act for one's values only when no risk is involved is to give up values, is to forsake values. And of course, to forsake values is to forsake life. A rational man does not venture senselessly. He does not attempt the impossible. He does not indulge in grandiose, empty gestures that can result only in his destruction. But when crucial values are at stake, he accepts the fact that the risk of his life itself may be necessary. Thus, the man who, to choose an obvious example, the man who consciously and willingly risks his life in the attempt to escape a dictatorship, the man who dies in the effort to achieve freedom, is acting on the principle of man's life as the standard of value. He knows what human existence is, and he will not accept anything less. He is unwilling to endure and regard as normal a non-human state of being, that is, a state where men act and function with a gun aimed at their heads, with destruction aimed at their values, and with escape from death, not the achievement of life, as the best they can hope for. It is in the name of the life proper to man that a rational person may be willing to die, not as treason to his life, but as the only act of loyalty possible to him. Conversely, the man who makes terms with the rulers of a dictatorship, the man, let's say, who delivers his wife and closest friends to destruction in exchange for being allowed to survive, it is this man that does not hold man's life as his standard of value. His motive is terror of dying, not a passion for living. He is willing to sacrifice every value he had ever found. He is willing to live without values and to surrender that which had been their root, his mind, his independence, his judgment, his love, in order to gain the security of a caged animal. Remember that the concept man's life and value are very wide abstractions, are they not? For every individual man, the value of life is experienced by him through the particular values he has chosen. These constitute the source of his enjoyment of life, and that enjoyment is the emotional fuel that keeps him moving. The greatest of these, as we shall see in subsequent lectures, the greatest of these values to anticipate are work and love. And such values can become irreplaceable. That is, once holding them, a man may have no desire to live without them, without the particular values which grant the pleasure, the enjoyment, the fulfillment of his life. For this reason, a rational man might willingly risk death to save the life of the woman he loves, because the value of life to him has become inextricably tied to her existence. We're only wide open, let us say, with regard to the issue of values at the moment of birth. From that time on, we're forming concrete value attachments, and we're not in love with life as some sort of floating abstraction, or with values as some sort of disembodied instruction, but with our life and with the particular values we choose. That is what gives meaning and enjoyment to our life. The man who, in any and all circumstances, would place his physical self-preservation above any other value is not the lover of life. He's an abject traitor to life, to the human mode of life, because he sees no difference between a life proper to a rational being and the life of a mindless vegetable. He sees no value as non-expendable. His treason is not that he values his life too much, but that he values it too little. Quoting Francisco, to love a thing is to know and love its nature. To love life is to know and love the nature of life. And since life is a process of self-sustaining action, this means to love the process of self-sustaining action, to love the thought, the effort, the struggle, the challenges that such action entails. Don't imagine that the man who dreams only of security, therefore, and who's fearful of any risk, is the lover of life. That's the man who's in passionate, irrational rebellion against the very nature of life, because life does entail risk in the sense that it entails struggle. That is the nature of what life is and means. Anybody who says the only thing he has against life on earth is that all of his desires are not automatically guaranteed to him, except for that life would be wonderful, is the man who hasn't any understanding of what life is or what it means. That is the person who doesn't want to live in the literal meaning of the term. No, he doesn't want to live, because to live means that process which we have been concerned with discussing this evening, that process of accepting one's nature as a living organism, as a certain kind of organism, of pursuing values, of struggling, and that involves, to repeat, always the possibility of failure and defeat. One doesn't like it, one doesn't want to fail or to be defeated, obviously, but a rational man doesn't rebel against that which is metaphysically part of what life itself entails. Therefore, to accept or to hold man's life as one standard of value means to live in accordance with the principles that man's life qua man requires, and to accept the metaphysical nature of life as the base, as the starting point, as the context in which one frames or forms any particular values, desires, or goals which one might elect to pursue. One doesn't hold any values or goals rationally which are inimical to, incompatible with, the nature of what the existence of a living being is metaphysically. And observe to what extent, again referring you to the villains in Atlas Shrugged by way of demonstration, observe to what extent the very fundamental essence of the evil of the villains, again using James Taggart as the simplest, purest example, is their virulent hatred of the very nature of life. That is what it means when Galt speaks of them as functioning on the death premise. James Taggart is against all of the cardinal aspects which life requires or which serves life, from intelligence to ability on the one hand, to the phenomenon of challenge or risk on the other. Human life is exactly what he actively disvalues and feels the most, if you could elevate resentment into a metaphysical emotion, that's James Taggart's attitude towards the very metaphysical nature of life. And here what you want to appreciate is the fact that a mere fear of dying or fear of the pain of dying has nothing whatsoever to do with dedication to life. Because dedication to life means dedication to the life process. And that's what any irrationalist, such as James Taggart, is conspicuously not dedicated to. Well, if man is to live efficaciously, what are the fundamental principles of action which must guide him? The first of these, and the most fundamental, is, as we have seen, the exercise of the virtue of rationality. Next week, we shall continue our discussion of the other principles of action which are required by man's life, and shall discuss not only what these principles of action are, but why they are required by man's life, and in what way they support and further man's life. To be continued.